From the moment I saw her leaning against the rail, looking out into the night, I knew I had to save her. Hey, miss, this way to the lifeboats.
What? Oh, the lifeboats? You're not serious.
Why, yes, as a matter of fact, I am. This way, come. It's bad, believe me. Oh, but she had already run back to the ballroom. I quickly made my way to the lifeboats and jumped into the last one, just as it cast off. I was safe, but I wish she'd come with me.
And we hope you'll come with us now on The Lifeboat Show, here on Coast Community Radio. The content and opinions expressed on The Lifeboat Show are solely the responsibility of the producers and are not the expressed opinion of KMUN, its board of directors, or the Tillicum Foundation. This program was pre-recorded.
This is Christopher Patton with my co-host, Karen Black, welcoming you to A Plan to Prosper. Our show on emergency preparedness featured local experts giving information about what to do to protect our homes and families against natural disasters or other catastrophic occurrences. Today's show sort of bookends that show, coming at preparedness from the other side.
What you won't hear from our guest, Anna Marie Jones, are statistics about what could go wrong on some unspecified day in the near or distant future. She'll talk instead about how skills that make every day go better also protect us during disasters. Franklin Roosevelt said, "We cannot always build the future for our youth, but we can build our youth for the future." That same could be said of our families and communities. We cannot always build the ideal future for them either, but we can build resilient families and communities who will thrive whatever comes our way.
Many of the people Anna Marie works with have already known disaster. They are living it. They are homeless, handicapped, battered, abused, what she terms first victims, because these people have the fewest resources with which to weather catastrophic events. She's a passionate advocate for ending America's disaster victim cycle and building resilient communities where even the most vulnerable members will survive, thrive, and prosper in the face of disasters and emergencies.
Anna Marie is Executive Director of CARD, Collaborating Agencies Responding to Disasters, a nonprofit located in the San Francisco Bay Area. Before joining CARD in April 2000, Ms. Jones worked for the California Governor's Office of Emergency Services, Coastal Region, on projects supporting community organizations and people with special needs. She served on the Bioterrorism Planning Project for Alameda County, toured Tokyo and Kobe to share an alternative approach to disaster preparedness at the request of the Japanese government and research institutes, and once served with the Red Cross. She's a faculty member of the UC Berkeley Center for Infectious Disease Preparedness. I had the pleasure of attending two of her seminars at the recent Pacific Northwest Citizen Corps Conference in Portland, where she is an outstanding hit. Anna Marie Jones, welcome to The Lifeboat Show.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's great to have you with us. Anna Marie, you've said information does not equal inspiration. When do people really start to work on disaster preparedness?
We've found that most people jump into preparedness immediately after disasters, taking away the whole preparedness angle and making it sort of the short-term thing they do just because they've been scared. I basically feel that preparedness has turned into more or less a protection racket. We keep telling people, do this or bad things will happen. Buy these things from us or, you know, you could lose your house. Maybe your family will die. And that's not the most motivating way to engage the community. I truly believe that people self-select out of the preparedness conversation. Anyone who doesn't trust government, anyone who doesn't like being threatened, anyone who doesn't want to believe that bad things will happen can just choose to ignore the conversation, mainly because it has been portrayed in such a negative vein. Whereas if we taught people the other side of preparedness, the happy, joyous, love fest part of it, then I believe more people would take it on.
Happy, joyous, love fest. Okay, tell us about that part.
From the perspective that we use here, we serve the most vulnerable members of our community. In our world, it would be grossly inappropriate to go into communities where people are already poor, they're already dealing with social issues, they have health concerns, and all of those things, and to bring a little more misery into their lives. So we show how preparedness can be something that builds community and truly allows people to walk the world feeling safer and more connected immediately. And of course, in a crisis, they will certainly be safer and better able to address their needs.
Another problem I heard you discuss was the uniformity of approaches like the 72-hour kit and so forth.
We have really taken on in this country that one message can serve everyone. And in truth, no company that sells products or services would ever just take on that every single customer needs to hear the exact same message from the exact same messenger. If you think in terms of Bill and Melinda Gates and their three children, or Julia Roberts and her husband Danny Motor and their three kids, should they get the same preparedness message as an immigrant family with three children, or maybe a homeless family with three kids? But in this country, that is what we have done. We have decided that everyone needs to just do the same things and hear it in the same way by the same messengers. And truly, that would not work for any company that really wanted to succeed.
So when it comes to emergency preparedness, one size does not fit all.
It never has, and it never will. It's too intimate a conversation. It really speaks to what you value most, what your particular needs are, what your particular fears and concerns are, and truly it can change from house to house, from day to day. So the idea that one message could possibly ever reach and serve and empower everyone really doesn't work.
You have a background in marketing also, don't you?
Yes, I spent the first 10 years of my life in advertising and marketing research in New York City, so when I became a professional preparedness geek several years ago, I was able to incorporate the wherewithal of marketing into it all.
And how do you market it?
Truly as a happy, sloppy love fest rather than the fear factor game. Mm-hmm. We spend as little time as we possibly can talking about the horrible things that could happen, and we spend as much time as we can talking about the things that every single person can do, the ways that we can build ourselves and our communities so that we are solution finders and problem solvers and creative thinkers and people that can do the best they can with whatever they've got. And those are skills I believe will serve us every single day. Every single day, we will be better for having built those skills into our community.
It seems to me the odds of fate handing us the disaster that we've prepared for with our disaster kit nearby aren't 100%.
Absolutely.
So you're talking about building the skills that will work in any situation, whether it's your everyday situation or whether it's a dreadful emergency.
Absolutely, and you pointed to what I believe to be one of the greatest causes of failure in a disaster. Professional emergency managers are oftentimes drilled to respond to a particular type of incident, whether it's an earthquake, a flood, or a fire, and they are accustomed to drilling in a particular manner, mm-hmm. where they show up to their emergency operations center and they walk through certain procedures. And just the chances that the disaster is going to unfold exactly in that manner are slim to none. And so you can imagine how people who are not professional responders and the crisis happens and they pull that disaster binder off the shelf, the minute they open it up, they're going to be looking for solutions. They're going to be looking for that circumstance to unfold before them. And what they're going to find is this binder, one, does not necessarily speak a language that they are familiar with. Most people haven't spent all that time reading and polishing what was in the binder. So it appears almost like Greek to them as they open it up. They've got all of the emotions running through their bodies. They're feeling the anxiety. Maybe they're concerned about their own families. And suddenly this binder is supposed to tell them exactly what they should do for a circumstance they've never actually truly experienced. So I think building the capacity to be that critical thinker, to be able to generate new solutions, is by far the higher path toward making a community genuinely resilient, and certainly moving away from big, thick disaster binders. We never, in fact, hand out a disaster binder. Never. Never. Ever.
So it's more of a course in creative problem solving?
That's a huge part of our classes, but even in our classes where we're talking about creating a disaster plan, we focus on the ways to do that. How do you take on disaster planning so that it is engaging of all people? How do you do it so that it provides immediate benefit? All of the ways that if we just learned how to work with each other right now, we would be better off when we have a crisis and need to work together.
As a volunteer fireman, I have a good feeling for what you're talking about, Anna Marie. We drill every week, and we have a wonderful center here called the Mertz Center, where they can simulate different types of fire. And we go through different drills, having to put out different types of fires. When I first trained in there, I thought, wow, this feels like it's the real thing. Then we actually did what they call a burn-to-learn exercise in a nearby town, where they started actual fires inside rooms, and we had to go in and put them out. And it was a totally different experience from the one that was simulated in the training center.
And even that real situation is still staged. It's not
right.
Somebody's home where you don't know if everybody's out of the house.
Right, exactly. You had some exercises that families could use for practicing this type of problem-solving skill, like one with a gallon Ziploc bag?
We are freakishly devoted to zip-top bags as a tool for teaching people the lowest level of creative thinking. We often hand out zip-top bags to everyone in the room, and then I show people two ways to use it. One is to just take a cheap everyday flashlight and put it inside the zip-top bag, and then we ask the audience, okay, what have we created here? Of course, everyone gets that we've now made this flashlight water-resistant. In the other example, I usually take a printed piece of paper, put it inside the zip-top bag. Okay, now what have I done? And it's a very cheap form of laminate, and I could take that piece of paper and hand it out to 100 people, and it would still be legible. I could post it on the door, and it would stand up to wind and rain. It would just mean that that note, that piece of information, is now made more resilient. Then I give the audience some time to just generate ideas. The ideas can be silly, they can be sexy, they can be serious, they can be very practical, whatever crosses their mind. The only thing they have to do is think of a creative way to use a zip-top bag, and it can be for preparedness or response. And truly, the audience can generate well over 100 answers. The largest crowd I ever did the exercise with was probably 140 people. They were still generating new ideas by the time I reached the 125th person. People are funny, and they come up with great and brilliant ideas. Just in the world of emergency medical, it's little things like if you don't have gloves, you could put your hand inside multiple zip-top bags and still do a bit of first aid. If I had to do rescue breathing, we could cut a little hole and still give each other mouth-to-mouth without exchanging fluids. If you had something in your eye, I could put water in the bag and pop a little hole and use it as an irrigation system. I could certainly collect evidence. I could make it an ice pack. I could make it a hot pack. I could do any number of things with just a little creativity. Each group tends to generate their own set of solutions. So if we do the exercise with kids, we develop completely different answers than when we did it with a crowd of EMTs. Kids are brilliant, and by the way, kids aren't embarrassed. They will continue the game long after you have stopped them. You truly learn so much about what is in their hearts about preparedness. The best answer we ever got using the zip-top bag exercise was from a little boy. He was very serious, whereas all the rest of the kids were giggling. I put my candy or my iPod or my whatever. He held up his zip-top bag, and he said that he would save his goldfish.
All right.
He was completely serious and clear that that zip-top bag is how that goldfish got in the house, and that's how that goldfish is going to get out of the house.
That's terrific.
Priceless.
Well, and think, every other kid put their zip-top bag on the table when they were done. He folded his and took it with him.
Oh, for his goldfish.
Imagine what it would mean to be the parent of that child and to understand that in a crisis, his heart is going to be rushing back to save the goldfish. For parents to know that would give that parent the opportunity to say the right thing to the kid, to plan ahead, rather than just in the disaster realize, oh my goodness, I don't know where my child has gone.
And that's a great example. When we did it at the conference, the point isn't the answers themselves. If you gave us a booklet with all the answers written out, no, we wouldn't read it, probably.
Right.
But when you come up with them yourself, you may not have a Ziploc bag during an emergency. But whatever you do have, it's learning to look at it in a different way. What could I do with this other than the usual?
Absolutely. And so we use many, many critical thinking exercises. We have disaster problem solving exercises we do in other classes. And all of it is to generate multiple answers to get people to see themselves as the solution to the problem. We need to wean ourselves off of believing that the government and Red Cross and Homeland Security and that everybody else is going to ride in and save us. We should be generating that ourselves.
Also, it's fun.
Oh, and lots of laughter and silly answers. It just sparks more creativity.
Much more can be accomplished in community.
Absolutely. It's part of our couch potato preparedness philosophy as well.
Tell us about that.
You can learn so much by watching television. For example, if you remember the TV show Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? A game show, actually. They had three ways that a contestant could get help. Number one was they would take away two of the four answers, so you had a 50-50 shot of getting the question right. Another one was you could phone a friend. The third choice was to poll the audience. 91% of the time, the audience came up with the right answer. 91% of the time. To me, that was a remarkable thing to learn, how often the community, if left to its own devices, will generate the correct approach.
So democracy is possible.
Yeah, I do believe in it. No matter how unpopular the concept grows, I will stand for it.
Let us remind you that you're tuned to Coast Community Radio. Stay tuned at 10 for Lost Highway. Now, back to the Lifeboat Show.
The practice of coming up with these solutions is empowering. It teaches that you're not a victim.
Absolutely. And even if you're not good at generating on the spot, as some people aren't, you can be the one to say, whoa, wait a minute, who here can think of a good way to use this item?
I'm going to interrupt us here and credit Kenny Loggins over the break there with Heartlight. Now, I want to ask how you became a professional preparedness geek, as you called yourself a little earlier, because I thought that was a very heartwarming story.
I got into the world of emergency preparedness over 40 years ago. When my little sister was born, my mother looked me dead in the eyes and said, don't let anything happen to her. From the time I was 3.5 years old, I truly believed that my role was to protect. And being that we didn't have money and we didn't have a lot of resources, it meant planning ahead, being a fast thinker if something should go wrong, because, of course, I could not let anything happen to my little sister.
And how is your sister?
She is fabulous. It was good
so
practice.
So it worked. Tell us about the whistle and flashlight.
Oh, if I could legislate one thing, everyone should walk the world carrying a teeny tiny high-pitched whistle and the mini LED flashlight on their keychain. Number one, it would mean that everyone would have an alerting and warning system on them, mm-hmm. always. How many children would not be abducted because they would have a whistle to blow should a stranger come toward them? How many seniors would not be hit in the crosswalk at night if they had a bright light that they could flash as they were crossing? If we did have an emergency, how many people would be able to direct traffic and do all sorts of helpful things if they simply had the whistle and flashlight? When we begin to talk about pandemic flu planning, imagine being able to stay in your nice, safe home. And when some nice Ricky Rescue sort drives by and says with the loudspeaker, house number 302, do you need food or water? From the safety of your own home, you could flash with the light. If you know the safety code, one is yes, two is no, and three is help. You could communicate while keeping safe social distance. There are so many ways that a simple whistle and simple flashlight could make all the difference in the world. And frankly, most of your listeners would not care whose name or logo was on the whistle or flashlight that saved their lives. So if businesses took on just a portion of their marketing and swag budget and made it whistles and flashlights instead of mouse pads and mugs, you could have your entire community armed with whistles and flashlights and make an immediate difference.
The most useful business card we've ever gotten was from a realtor friend who gives out little tiny Swiss knives, which come in really handy.
Wow. So,
listeners, take note. We've got ours now, since Anna Marie said, go get these. I did. So we're set.
And in other practical ways, if you looked around my office, every door frame, I have a whistle and flashlight hanging. So if we had an emergency here and my program manager, Scott, evacuated, I would be able to walk in his office, see that his whistle and flashlight is missing from the door frame, and immediately that would give me a visual clue as to what's going on. I would also rest easier knowing if he would be able to signal and that sort of thing. To outfit the entire office and everybody on my staff was easily less than $20.
And that is a great signal if something's not there. Agency clipboards for a business or an office or a school.
As I mentioned earlier, we don't believe in the big, thick disaster binder. They're intimidating, and it's very hard to figure out what you need when the crisis actually happens. So we have our agency plan on a little clipboard with name tags. The name tags have strings on them, and so if you're the one in charge, you pick up the tag that says the incident commander, and you put it around your neck. On the back of the name tag, it spells out the things you would have to do as the incident commander. So literally, you would have it around your neck. You'd be able to peek down and have it remind you of the critical things you need to do. We help agencies tailor the name tag system to meet the specifics of their agency. Simple checklists. And literally, the first thing at the top of each checklist is to take a deep breath. The next thing it tells you to do is put your name tag on. Then it tells you what to do to walk yourself through the process of responding. So if you can read and make check marks, you can basically get through 90-some-odd percent of what a responder would need to do in a crisis.
what happens during a disaster is critical thinking goes out the window. We're
Absolutely.
In fight or flight, and it's very difficult to reason. So having things already prepared.
Under stress, people can forget their own phone numbers. So just having it spelled out so simply makes all the difference in terms of your confidence, your clarity, and all of that.
Anna Marie, we discovered that a recent AARP poll showed that 44% of respondents felt prepared to deal with weather-related disasters, and 88% knew what to do to be self-sufficient for up to 3 days. 63% felt confident in their city or county government to provide emergency services. In our previous emergency preparedness show, emergency service representatives all emphasized that they are stretched too thin to provide all the necessary support during a major emergency, and people need to be self-sufficient for at least 3 days, up to 2 weeks. Can you comment on this gap between public confidence and actual capacity for preparedness and response?
I believe, and again, this is my marketing background, it's that we have spent over 100 years and many billions of dollars telling people that we are ready. So it's not surprising that people absolutely believe that they know what's going to happen and people are going to help and people are ready. And in truth, some communities have never, ever had their needs met. And now with cutbacks and more disasters to prepare for and the level of training and grants management that the response agencies have to do, in many ways they are less able to address our growing community. Until we absolutely change the messaging, you're still going to find people grossly overestimating their level of personal preparedness and grossly overestimating how able our response agencies are to respond to our needs.
I was surprised by this survey because it just came out this month, and this is after Katrina.
There's a myth about being prepared and everything's going to be taken care of for us.
Yes, in 2 years of having the realities of Katrina pushed in our face, it's simply not going to erase the 100 years of the other message.
And again, it's a negative message versus a positive one, and it's much more comfortable to feel that we're prepared and that someone's going to come to the rescue than it is to think that maybe we need to be a little more self-reliant.
No, absolutely, and we like to believe that Hurricane Katrina was the extreme and it couldn't happen again, and we've learned so many lessons, and look at how many millions of dollars, in fact, billions of dollars have now been poured into our response system, and, you know, all of those things tell us, oh, it's going to be okay, it's going to be okay.
Anna Marie, your organization, Collaborating Agencies Responding to Disasters, CARD, helps emergency response groups coordinate their efforts. How do you do this in a small community?
By creating that shared reality of what is possible at the micro and the macro levels. If you had every family taking on an empowered version of preparedness, and truly it can start at the most simple level of the whistles and flashlights and the zip-top baggy exercises, and then you take that up through your community agencies and your small businesses. If you had a shared vision of everyone being able to love and care for each other and share resources, and you incentivized preparedness, then preparedness would be that loving, bonding experience, which would work whether it's a very small, close-knit community or a larger community. It's taking away the negative, putting in the positive, making people generate their own solutions, being the wind beneath their wings, rather than the didactic leader at the front of the room telling you this is what you need to do.
You mentioned businesses. How do you train local businesses?
It can be the tiniest little things. For example, if you're the technology person inside a business, you have the capacity to keep that business able to operate by doing things like backing up all of your computer information, putting critical emergency response information on zip drives and programming people's cell phones, keeping records offsite. I mean, there are hundreds of little teeny tiny and great and fabulous things that just the IT person could do.
That's true, I'm sure, because I worked for FEMA after the Loma Prieta earthquake, just before the loans ran out, before FEMA pulled up stakes and left town. People were madly scrambling to put together 3 years worth of financial data. At the last minute, they were trying to put all this together, and of course, most of those records had been destroyed.
Oh, absolutely.
How would you advise local city government leaders and county commissioners to help their communities prepare?
Number one, absolutely ditch every bit of the fear and threat-based messaging. Allow people to hear the conversation newly. Empower leaders, ones that have never spoken about preparedness, to incentivize preparedness. We always recommend that they start with something that is obviously and immediately beneficial. It could be as simple as the whistles and flashlights. Another favorite here is something called our potty poster initiative. We created preparedness information on 8.5 by 11 paper, great big graphics, simple instructions meant to be placed inside the restroom stalls, because most people won't read a brochure, but everybody reads whatever is in a bathroom stall with them. But start somewhere.
It's almost like we need to revive the old civil defense program.
I believe we have progressively made ourselves less prepared by taking the responsibility away from people and making it that somebody else, whether it was local government or Red Cross or Homeland Security or somebody else, was going to be doing it. There was a time where we had that in every building. I grew up in New York City, and in the basement of the building I lived in, there was a room, and it had the little black and yellow circular sign above it, and there were supplies in there. So I would like to see us turn that around and make it very personal and very intimate, and have every single business know its business and know what makes it possible for that business to stay up and operational. Imagine what it would be if every one of your restaurants knew the shelf life of every piece of food they had, so that in an emergency, they were crystal clear on the order in which to eat things, which things will last, which things are going to need refrigeration, and all of that. I'm very big on whatever the system is for communicating and sharing resources, build that. Preparedness should be so personal and so reflective of the actual situation. A very rural community oftentimes is way more prepared than city dwellers who have the local store right on the corner.
People who are used to going to the store every other day or whatever, a lot of them don't really understand that there's perhaps only 3 days supply on the store shelves.
Oh, absolutely. And we see that in the big cities here. It seems very reasonable that, hey, if anything happens, I'll just run to the store.
Right.
Very false sense of security.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if local groups want to get in touch with you, how do they do that?
Well, what I would say to do is to go to our website, which is www.firstvictims.org. And what they'll find there is some of our online trainings. And certainly, if a group calls and requests it and we can arrange it, we are trying to actively share our Train the Trainer program and get more communities into the prepare to prosper rather than prepare for disasters mindset.
Is there anything else you would like to add for our listeners, Anna Marie?
The one thing I would say, and it's along the lines of the zip-top bags, is to just have your eyes open for all the different ways that any simple item could be a life-saving tool in a crisis, like a simple Sharpie marker. In Hurricane Katrina, if we had told people to just scavenge for lipstick or paint, or if we had dropped Sharpie markers and told people to write their names across their chests and their backs, or on their arms even, it would have changed everything. It would have humanized people for each other. They wouldn't have been the helpless, hopeless, faceless strangers. It would have meant that that helicopter or satellite image would have been immediate confirmation of life for their families. And frankly, if I didn't make it back alive, my family would still have wanted my body back. They wouldn't have wanted to wait 10 months. And we're going to spend millions of dollars in DNA and dental record identification just because we didn't think to give people that simple tool.
Well, thank you very much, Anna Marie, for joining us in our lifeboat today.
Lots of good information.
Thank you so much for having me. I greatly appreciate being invited.
Please join us next month, August 20th, as we talk with Jim and Krista in rural upstate New York about their experience building a self-reliance campus. Until then, I'm Christopher Padden.
With Karen Black.
Urging you and your family to play 101 Ways to Use a Ziploc Bag.
Rent some old MacGyver episodes.
Think outside the box.
And support your community lifeline.
Your community radio station, Coast Community Radio. For more information, email lifeboatshow@charter.net.